I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, one of Granter's best of young American novelists, Joshua Cohen, on his latest book, Moving Kings. Joshua Cohen was born in 1980 in Atlantic City. He has written a number of novels, including Book of Numbers, short fiction, including Four New Messages, and non-fiction for The New York Times, Harper's Magazine, London Review of Books, M Plus One, and others. And in 2017, he was named one of Granter's best young American novelists. Joshua's latest novel is Moving Kings, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Joshua, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe Moving Kings?
As a book everyone should buy immediately without listening to the remainder of this podcast.
That's fair enough, we're done. So I'll be talking to Joshua Cohen.
Right, you can just put in the cash register sound right there. I don't know, Moving Kings. I mean, to me it was really, it's a book about really existing in two worlds. One is the world of movers in New York City, what they call here removalists, right? And guys who work, moving anyone's home, but also specialize in eviction moving. Especially following the 2008 financial crisis, when people are having their homes repossessed and are being evicted. And so these are people who kind of go in and forcibly remove people from their properties and remove their property, store them, and sort of hold those possessions ransom. So it follows a man who owns a moving and storage company in North Jersey that really services all of the kind of greater New York area. And then the other half of the book really concerns his cousin and his cousin's world, and that takes place in Israel. And it follows members of a squad who served in the Gaza War and who are getting out of their compulsory military service. They're all 21 years old. And they're going on what's become really a tradition in Israel, which is sort of a time off or time abroad, a trip abroad, following the conclusion of their military service. And so, you know, members of the squad go to Southeast Asia, they go to South America, they go to beaches, they go to cities in Europe and kind of hang out. And this one cousin comes to New Jersey, actually, and works as a mover. And one of his friends from the squad follows him. And they begin to see some rhyme or some at least similarities between the work that they were forced to do in the IDF and the work that they're doing on the ground in gentrifying Brooklyn and Queens.
In comparison to your previous novels, this is more narratively straightforward, perhaps less experimental, and more specifically briefer. Book of Numbers was 600 page plus, and Wits over 800. Mm-hmm. Specifically with the length, was that a sort of conscious decision to do something shorter?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, for me, I mean, everything has its appropriate length. I mean, you know, Four New Messages was 200 some pages, maybe even 180 pages. A book of mine called The Heaven of Others was about 100 something. I think people just, you know, everyone else is a size queen, not me. I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, something like the internet, which was Book of Numbers, was really, you know, took that as its subject, you know, really required something that at least superficially had to have a physical presence that rivaled, you know, the almost psychological size of the internet, what we all perceive to be the enormity of the internet. And certainly that there were just so many options there. This, you know, if there's any correlation between length and subject in Moving Kings, it's really that these are characters who are straitened. They're stuck in their fate, and it doesn't really feel like they have that many options. These are people who went right from their parental homes into the army. you know, going in at 17, 18 years old, and then going through the army for 3 years. And only then, finally at 21, kind of coming out into the world. And it doesn't really feel like there are many options available to them, but they're not even sure what those options would be. They feel straightened into certain existences. They feel certainly straightened into certain political ideologies. And so, in a sense, the book, you know, its brevity might reflect that, but certainly its terseness should reflect that. The idea that there are no kind of, you know, fictional trap doors in which one can just conveniently slip through to live another life, that there are actually consequences to meandering from the path that you were given. And I wanted to kind of duplicate or in some way bring to life that sense of being sentenced to life and of being kind of fated to a certain existence.
Let's look at the characters a bit more closely then. So David King, rather symbolically named David King, King David, rather clearly. Who is he?
Well, thank God someone's accused me of doing the obvious thing for once, right? he's the owner of this moving company, of this removalist company, King's Moving. And he is, you know, he's in my mind, a kind of an archetypal figure, especially these days. He is a, you know, he's the son of Holocaust survivors growing up in New Jersey. He kind of always views himself as being forced by dint of certain discrimination to getting involved in a business that other people didn't want to be involved in, a dirty business. You know, and his feeling was someone has to do this business, you know, and this is sort of the corner into which he feels he was painted.
That's a sort of self-justification.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, it's very much a self-justification of that is, I think, in my mind, emblematic of a lot of people of the white working class in America, people who you could call Trump voters. I mean, in fact, the book opens with a scene in the Hamptons at a July 4th fundraiser for a Republican committee in the state of New York for a person running for Senate in New York on the Republican ticket. And I think he has a lot of those delusions. I think that he, you know, he's a self-made man, very much so. But that self-made man thing, despite his great success, has led to resentment because, you know, the amount of effort and psychological distress and physical distress that it kind of took him to build this business, he's looking at his life in any way besides economic, meaning emotionally, his relationship with his family is in tatters. And he's angry about this. And he feels like he's still owed something. How, if I could be so successful, am I still not happy? You know, and I still don't feel like I have gotten what I deserve. And so he has a lot of that, a lot of those questions that I think are fairly, again, emblematic of a certain outer borough, if not, you know, outside the cities, white working class in America. And at the same time, he's someone who has so fucked up his life with his daughter, Tammy, that he's really looking to be for an alternate child. You know, he wants to be a parent to someone. He wants to be able to feel like he's a father figure, you know, like he's useful in some way because his relationship with his daughter is so poisoned. And so when there's this opportunity to bring over his cousin, Yoav, from Israel, he immediately leaps at this because it's this idea of now I can redeem all of the mistakes I've made as a parent. And I can not only redeem them, but I can feel some sort of political conviction or I can feel some sort of political success in doing so and some political identity.
And you talk about him saying to himself, you know, why I'm a success, why am I not still happy? But of course, all of his problems with his family are self-inflicted, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but I think that, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, to blame yourself, you know, and it's also, you know, and also what is the point of blaming yourself? I mean, especially if you're a person like David and has various substance abuse issues, you know, you kind of see where blaming yourself takes you. I think a lot of his, you know, I didn't write a nonfiction book and I don't necessarily have a thesis about the soul of America. But I will say there is a degree to which this type of person, right, was raised very much on a post-war American dream, right? Which is this idea of anything that I work for, I can have. And which, you know, honestly, compared to the Oprah dream of the millennium, which is if I just want something, I'll get it, is actually, you know, a relatively laudable dream. But at the same time, you know, it's a dream that's, in this book specifically, is predicated on a job that, while entirely legal, is entirely discriminatory and hurtful. It's a job that, you know, while his moving business, which comprises a certain degree of his, you know, of his business in toto, is a regular business like anything else, the eviction moving, you know, is all in the outer boroughs and the gentrifying outer boroughs, and it's primarily moving minorities, moving, you know, black people and Latinos from their homes, usually clearing these homes so that they can be demolished to build new condos. And so, you know, in a sense, he has this he has this American dream that he can't even interrogate because it's so deeply entwined in the story of his generational coming of age.
And these are people that have been explicitly screwed by the subprime fiasco as well. We're talking about, you know, David's story is a story of immigration and success.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that now is not available for this sort of latest generation
of immigrants. So absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, and certainly not, you know, available for, you know, black citizens of America who, you know, have been citizens, official citizens since the end of slavery. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a clash of those ideologies. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think that, you know, again, you know, those ideologies clashing or the inherent paradox within, you know, the dominant ideology of the American dream is something that is that it's very difficult to be assimilated by, you know, by the baby boomer generation, right? I mean, it's something that's, you know, very easy for a millennial like myself to spout.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In a way, this is the world I was raised in.
Yeah.
Right? It was a world I was raised in where the same economic opportunities that were available to my parents were not available to me. You know, the ability to, you know, buy a house and have a family on, you know, even if I had a job that was less fucked up as writing, if writing is a job, like, you know, those aren't available to people. And mm-hmm. that's true across the board in mm-hmm. Western Europe, right? And in Eastern Europe as well. You know, and so in a sense, the way in which a baby boomer, post-war generation, encounters these ideologies is typically at the point at which they've realized they've failed with their children. And when their children sort of either rebel against them or at least, you know, reach some certain age where they say, you know, dad or mom, like, this is not right. The way that you've earned a living and earned the money to pay for my education that has taught me that this is mm-hmm. not right is in fact not right. You know, that's a very difficult thing for that generation to sort of assimilate. And so I wanted to write a book that talked about it from their perspective, that certainly talked about it from the perspective of the impacted parties, you know, who are being evicted. And I wanted to kind of do this perverse thing of having an Israeli soldier mm-hmm. being the almost only person in the book who can see both sides, and yet, of course, is perceived in certain ways by the people that he engages with.
I'm Ben Goldacre. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So before we bring in Yoav and Uri, the two soldiers, let's talk about David has this, I mean, obviously a tangible family, but also to him, vague connection to Israel, which is sort of raised again by Dina, Yoav's mother, David's cousin, getting back in touch. Back in the past, Dina's father and David's father have obviously, like, gone their separate ways.
Well, the war took them different ways. Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, it's the, you know, two paths of European post-war, you know, survivor emigration. You know, certain people went to Palestine, certain people went to the States. And so the family, in that sense, got split. So it's, you know, part of the book is following those two branches of the family and how they developed on either side. And yeah, I mean that to me is a fundamental part of the book. You know, the question of what are your allegiances? You know, on the American side, of course, ethnicity is the dark secret of American identity. You know, it's very difficult to have an identity in a democracy, right? You can either, because what do you identify with? Do you mm-hmm. identify with a framing document, a constitution? I mean, who can identify with words? You know, and certainly some people will tell you that who can identify with words written by, you know, white slave owners who were just attempting to shield themselves from a crazy British king. And in a sense, you know, the white ethnic identity in the United States, which people can condemn as being a prime motivator of a Trump election, right, is also the same thing that people enjoy watching whenever they watch a mafia movie, right? It's the idea of who maintains the social contract,
mm-hmm.
you know? And the question, you know, answered in America, especially in city neighborhoods, was you take care of your own, you take care of your blocks. It was, you know, your Landsmannschaften, your groups that you emigrated with. These things held enormous sway, and they held enormous sway for my parents' generation. Mm-hmm. And they really only break down with my own generation in terms of the degree to which those old world ties have been effaced, you know, by just distance, by people, you know, drifting. And I think, you know, one of the ways in which American Jews can look at Israel is as a authenticating stamp of identity. It's essentially saying, well, here is actually, you know, a Jewish national project that licenses our difference here in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a deeply authentic way of being, right? I mean, and that's, you know, certainly one argument that American Jewry has had. And I think that that's how David King perceives that. It's a license or justification for his own stance of it's me against the world.
So let's bring in then Yoav and I was going to say his friend, but he's not really his friend, his sort of army Conrad, Uri. Let's talk about their experience in the army then. You know, they're both clearly, they've finished their service, and there's this sort of ritual where everybody that comes out of the army goes off and travels for a bit,
right,
which seems like a sort of nice gap year, but really I guess they're basically, well, they both have some sort of form of PTSD, I guess.
Right. I mean, you know, you want to get into a fight in Israel, you don't even have to talk about politics, or you can just say PTSD. And, you know, a vast segment of the Israeli population, I would say the majority, would say, you know, it doesn't exist. It's like ADHD. It's something, you know, you guys made up.
Yeah.
You know, because it's very difficult to say our entire society has PTSD when you say that, you know, everyone serves.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, you know, Israel, which is a place that has a lot of, where so many things, especially with regarding to military service, are officialized and ritualistic.
Yeah.
You know, you have your induction ceremonies, and you have your, you know, your terms of service, and there are all of these ideas that, you know, of where you serve being in somehow some emblem of how you, of the life you would live outside of the army, because a lot of the contacts and connections you make inside the army are job contacts for afterwards. You know, one thing that isn't organized or isn't doesn't have any, you know, system about it is, in fact, this time afterwards. It is something that's deeply unofficial and is really it's really kept on the level of tradition as opposed to, you know, something that's state sanctioned. And a lot of it has to do with things that, you know, Israelis kind of don't want to talk about. You know, which is to say, they're in a country where, you know, and I should, of course, I feel, you know, stupid even saying this, but of course, everything I'm saying now, saying that obviously their position is vastly superior to the position of Palestinians living in the occupied territories, Palestinians living in Gaza. But I'm saying from the perspective of an Israeli soldier, someone who has, his passport is not recognized in every country. You know, it's not a country you can just drive out of. You know, you have to fly out of there, and you have to fly to a fairly distant country in order to somewhat be welcome. So it's the first time that these people have been abroad. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of times, it's the exact opposite of a lot of other people's experiences in life, where, you know, a lot of people go through their lives and say, you know, this is the first time I've met a Jew. For an Israeli, it's like this is a lot of time, the first time they've met someone who's not Jewish. And so in a lot of ways, this is an opening of their horizons. And I wanted to write about these two guys who, you're right, aren't friends, are just, you know, they're thrown into a military unit and they have to deal with each other. And in fact, you know, one saved another's life, or he saved, you know, Yoav's life. And they both resent that. Right, right. And they're also from, you know, from different kind of socioeconomic lives, or from like geographically different things. I mean, Yoav is a city kid. Uri is from the Negev, is from, you know, Netivot. It's like a Nika, a Moshav outside of Netivot. Like he's from the desert. You know, he's much more of a Mizrahi, an Arab Jew. I mean, you know, it's they come from these very different worlds, but they're sort of thrown together. And I think that, at least from Yoav's perspective, I wanted to write a character who's coming to political awareness. There's so many novels out there where there is a political bent to the novel, where you feel like the writer is trying to convince you of something politically. And there are very few books, right? And it was my folly that I was trying to write one that follows a character coming of political age, mm-hmm. actually realizing these are the ideas that I was raised with. This is why they might be wrong. This might be right. This might be the corrective to how I was raised. I'm not really sure how to negotiate the transition, and I'm not really sure what effects of making that transition are going to have on my relationships back home. And it's that classic thing of having to leave your home to see your home clearly. And I think that that's what I wanted to have Yoav do. I wanted Brooklyn and Queens being the necessary catalysts for him to actually reflect back on Israel's own policies. And the Bronx. I don't know why I always leave out the Bronx and Staten Island.
I wanted to talk about how, specifically this part, the service in the IDF, how you went about researching that, but perhaps for a different prism. I recently interviewed the writer Nicole Krauss, and mm-hmm. we talked about the reception of her work in Israel mm-hmm. as an American Jewish writer. And I wonder, the same question to you, really, like how you find your work received. And this one's obviously just coming out, but you're writing mm-hmm. about Israeli men serving in the war, serving in the army, mm-hmm. something that, I mean, I guess you've not had to do because of circumstance, you know?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in terms of my own research about the book, it's all based on family, on, you know, on cousins who served. And my belief about reception of a book, you know, I don't know what Nicole's answer was, and I'm sure it was, I'm sure it was accurate to her experience. You know, my own experience is that the people who read books in every country are pretty much alike, you know, and that the people who would really be pissed off at me aren't going to read this thing in the first place. With regard to Israel, again, I mean, I think that, look, there's an arrogance, certainly, in writing about military service when, you know, I myself haven't served. But I also believe there's an arrogance in absolutely everything. I mean, I've never also been a tech billionaire, but I wrote a 600-page book about it, you know? I mean, I think that, you know, you call it something else other than arrogance, it's a little bit more polite, but it's sort of necessary to the imaginary projection of yourself. I mean, I'm not from the autofiction school that says, you know, I need to write about my life because what happens to me is so interesting to everyone, because what happens to me is not interesting in the least. I mean, it would at most be interesting to, like, my brother, my sister, and my parents, but not in a positive way would it be interesting to them. You know, so I will always reserve the right to project myself into, you know, into other selves. And I do think that the way that said, I think that, you know, you do need to earn some credentials to do that. And I think, but I think that comes from research. And I think that also comes from, you know, from at least understanding the moral stakes involved. I, in terms of, like, reception, again, I mean, I think that, you know, the Israeli left is actually more critical of their own politics than the American left is critical of Israeli politics. And when I say critical, I mean there's a difference between criticism and anti-Semitism and the true critique in terms of, like, policy critiques, not just condemning, but saying, like, this is actually what should be done and this is how it should be done. You know, I mean, that to me, the Israeli left, you know, or what is left of the Israeli left is actually, you know, doesn't need my help. Doesn't need actually the help of any left of any country, except that, you know, they might need our support, but I don't think they need my help as to, you know, direction as to what to do. In terms of, you know, in terms of someone reading, I mean, I think that I was trying to do two things that have never been done in American Jewish fiction and that are rarely done in Israeli fiction. You know, one is that is writing really about the time after the army, which is something that or writing about Israel in general in the time after that, which is certainly not something that the Bellow, Roth, you know, Cynthia Ozick generation did. You know, their subject was really, you know, American Jews in America. So I think Israel is very much more a subject of my generation. But really, it was about showing Israel as it exists. You know, and my sense of Israel as it exists is a country that doesn't feature what we all understand as the Ashkenaz picture of quintessential Jewry, which is to say, you know, the chassid with the shtreimel and the payas and the tzitzit and the whole, you know, thing and the black coats, right? It, you know, Israeli society is now majority Mizrahi, you know, meaning, you know, Israelis who are descended from Jews from Arab countries. Many of them, including the characters in the book, grew up in households that speak Arabic as a native language. And in fact, you know, in Israel, the word, you know, Ashkenaz, right, which is, you know, a European Jew, right, the guy with the beard and the yarmulke, is really a synonym for, a slang synonym for weakness. You know, when I say, you know, maybe peace, maybe this, maybe this, they say, don't be such an Ashkenaz, meaning don't be this kind of European humanist bleeding heart. My family grew up in Morocco. My family grew up in Yemen. My family grew up in Egypt. My family grew up in Iran. I know, quote unquote, these people. And I know that there's nothing you can do to deal with them, right? Because these all come from families who were kicked out of these countries between the 50s and the 80s. And that is a hardline right-wing force in Israeli life. And it's, so its politics are different. Its culture is different. Its aesthetics are different. And it's a mode of life that hasn't actually been represented in fiction in English, and actually isn't very well represented in Israeli literature either. I mean, so much of Israeli literature actually of the 70s was, or not so much, there was a small faction of Israeli literature in the 70s that was trying to overthrow the Ashkenaz hegemony, you know, the European hegemony. And they called themselves, you know, Hapantarim HaShachorim, you know, the Black Panthers. And these were, you know, Arab Jews who were saying, we're tired of this kind of humanist Yiddishkeit Kafka bullshit. Like, get Europe out of here. Like, let's talk about, we're Jews in the Middle East. Let's talk about what that means. And I wanted to kind of engage with those ideas because those are really much more, in my mind, the facts on the ground than these sort of 20th century looking Western humanist Ashkenaz ideals, which I think are beautiful, but they're tainted with the mark of martyrdom. They're sort of tainted with the Holocaust. And I wanted to put that aside and look at another phenomenon altogether.
And there's clearly a class element there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, you know, they would say, in fact, some of the arguments of Mizrahi society in Israel are very, very close to the arguments of Black Americans, you know, Hispanic Americans, which is, say, you know, being, you know, systematically discriminated against in university admissions, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, in a lot of ways, some of the early statehood things, you know, from the very beginnings of Israeli statehood and even a little bit before it, you know, you had all of these movements like the Canaanite movement, which was essentially to say, we shouldn't have a Jewish national home like a Zionist. You know, we should have this sort of pan-Canaanite, Jewish Arab homeland that talks about our common roots in this culture and the common linguistic roots. And so I wanted to really show a different face.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Joshua Cohen. We're talking about his latest novel, Moving Kings. And Joshua, moving on to the third part of the book, we haven't really said, but the book's split into roughly three parts, and the first part focusing mainly on David King, the second on Yoav Anuri, and the third part introduces another character, mm-hmm. Avery Luther, or Imamu. Tell us who he is.
He is a guy who, you know, he grew up, I made up the neighborhood. It's sort of, because I didn't want to kind of do a specific neighborhood thing, but it's if you follow the geographic coordinates, it's kind of exactly on the seam between Brooklyn and Queens. Mm-hmm. And he lives in his mother's house, and he worked for years for the Port Authority, which is, you know, the bridges and tunnels around New York that lead out to the outer boroughs. And he's a toll collector, and, you know, which, you know, maybe was a heavy-handed move again, but, you know, toll collectors, I think, you know, they deserve their representation as well.
There's also this lovely bit there where he's specifically discriminated against by having to work in the tunnels rather than the bridges.
Right, exactly. He has to work underground. He's sort of kept underground and not, or at the entrance, the mouth to the underworld, and not allowed the fresh air of the bridges, as if the air around the bridges is that clean. But, yeah. And he follows a trajectory that might have become a little bit of a cliche, but actually is very, very true of a certain cohort. I mean, he was sent to Vietnam, and so he has his own kind of military experience, but it was not a military experience where he felt that he identified with the cause, mm-hmm. like Yoav Anuri. He was sent there, and he believes that he was sent, especially into the situations he was sent in, because of his race, because he's black. And he comes out, and he gets radicalized, but in a certain way, not in the way that we understand radicalization now, which is, you know, this Islamist, you know, let's blow stuff up radicalization, but in a, you know, late 60s American city Muslim way, you know, in Elijah Muhammad
Nation
way.
Of Islam.
Nation of Islam, yeah. Right. And he converts, and he lives a life until he gets really injured, and in a robbery attempt, and he has some pain afterwards, and he begins, abusing prescription opiates, and then he moves on to drugs on the street once his insurance sort of fails him, which is, sadly, a pretty typical story. And at a certain point, he can't make the payments on his mother's home, and he begins eviction proceedings against him. And the difference really with him is that he refuses to leave without a fight. And that's really the last act of the book. I see him very much as not just as a product of things that I have not experienced, like Vietnam or like conversion to Islam, but I see him as a product of something I have experienced, which is he's a city guy who has a city job, which is a good job in New York, is a city job. A Port Authority job is it pays well, and it is and it was a middle class job for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And a unionized job.
And a unionized job, right. Job, yeah. Right. Until they invent pretty much any way to kick you off those roles. Mm-hmm. And, one of them is a drug test. And that's what he fails. And so for me, it was really that sort of city existence, that way that you sort of can rely on your city to sort of employ you, and you can rely on that employment to guarantee you a certain way of life, and then having it all sort of collapse. And then being unable to kind of fight the powers against it. At the same time, I see him also as a generational remove, in the sense of, he doesn't have the political language of people my age. He has a political language of real resentment, of truly, truly felt resentment, mm-hmm. and in a sense, a corrupted ideology, which is really born of pretty bad, not only bad oppression, but also a bad run of luck, And I think that that mix, to my mind, was very potent in certain neighborhoods that I grew up around, and certain worlds that I saw, especially with the rise of Farrakhan and his mosques in the city.
And we can bring back in Yoav and Uri here, because obviously on the behalf of David King's company, they're basically, not only are they moving, mm-hmm. Removal men, as we call them over here, but they're basically doing the eviction. They're removing the people from these sort of mm-hmm. repossessed properties. And Yoav basically comes to the realization that that what he's doing in these houses is basically similar to what they were doing in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about that sort of connection.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you call it a connection, because I feel like we live in this world where people think that increasingly that metaphors are sort of mathematical equations, mm-hmm. or that there's some sort of scientific one-to-one mapping,
Yeah.
That gentrification equals Israeli occupation.
I've noticed that in some of the reviews.
Right. And really, I think of metaphors as sort of car accidents.
Mm.
You kind of take thing A and you take thing B and you smash them into each other, and you look at the kind of chaos that results, and how you perceive the result of that collision sort of diagnoses your own politics. It's how you react to that comparison, mm-hmm. that I find interesting. And so, I think that a character who has gone through these two experiences is bound to find some connection between them, because they involve some of the same outward physical actions. And he really sees sort of some of these same scenes. These scenes repeat themselves of, tearing people out of their homes, people refusing to leave, the robbing of someone's home while you're kind of taking some of their merchandise out, slipping stuff in your pocket. And I think that he begins seeing the ways in which countries, which people structure, their legal systems to essentially, legalize things that are morally crimes. And I think that this for him is a point at which is the point of his political awakening. And I think it's the point at which he begins understanding for the first time that there's something different, that there's a difference between something that's legal and something that's just.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, for most people, I think, it's easy to gloss over. Of course, there's a difference, in this world you get the law, in the next world you get justice, right? That kind of thing. But I think that seeing someone understand the difference between the two, and seeing someone kind of live the difference between the two, and understand that he himself is responsible for actually doing something, and yet he's not responsible because there's no legal repercussions to mm-hmm. what he's done, is so that any kind of recompense he can make, any atonement, is in fact on him. There's no official punishment except self-punishment, right, that really weighs on him. And I think that he tries to figure out what that situation entails. On the other hand, he has his friend Uri, who this isn't exactly a book that can be spoiled. So we'll say that, during the time when they're trying to evict Imamu Abi, there's this sort of standoff and there's this conflagration and the cops come. And I really, and the cops end up kind of shooting Uri, who's this dark guy who's screaming in a language that they don't understand, but sounds to them maybe like it's Arabic, and they shoot him. Mm-hmm. And I really see the Uri death as a sort of opposite side to where it can go. It's almost suicide by cop.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's kind of throwing himself out there because he doesn't know how to live in a world. He doesn't have the vocabulary to live in a world where the acts that he was asked to do, the acts that he not only were told were legal, that wasn't even a question, but were told were like moral and necessary to the survival of a culture, that those things were in fact immoral. And in fact, contributed to so much pain and suffering for people whom he didn't even consider human at the time.
And I'm glad you brought that up because, obviously, again, I didn't want to sort of get into spoilers for the book. But yeah, that part reminded me. And it's, it just so happens that we're recording this today on the day that, shit's going down in Las Vegas as well. But I was particularly reminded of, things like Ferguson and that sort of extrajudicial murders by police that have been going on. That's sort of what I was reminded of at that point.
Yeah, and the militarization of our streets. I mean, on one hand, you have, this happened, last night, right? Mm-hmm. You see this shooter that we know is like one shooter who opens up on an entire crowd at a music festival. And then you read that, a SWAT team neutralizes him, like this was this verb, immediately. And that's good. That they hadn't, many more would have been killed. But it's also the militarization of the police forces and the militarization of daily life that is also an interesting subject to me. So it's not just how the individual sort of breaks and how then the individual has recourse to firearms in order to to somehow more deeply impress their rage on the world. It's also how the response to it creates a certain military presence on streets and creates its own climate of fear. And I was thinking a lot actually about, when I was writing the book, especially in the early days of after the Boston Marathon bombing, and they shut down all of Boston. And suddenly you're seeing tanks on the street and you're seeing people in military gear. And it was the first time that I'd really seen that, with the exception of a presence down on 9/11, down at Ground Zero. And that it's also that militarization of daily life that I really wanted to write about, and the way in which we somehow... we rely on it because its antagonist has become so present, which is to say, the individual who breaks and has recourse to firepower.
Just going back to the idea of the evictions replicating the occupation, mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is even more of a stretch, but there's a scene in the book where we first get to see, David's facility, his warehouse, mm-hmm. And right. he's got all of these various units where there's all of these, piles and piles of stereo equipment and piles of furniture. And I was reading that and thinking of two things. And one of them was, Storage Wars. I've sort of seen episodes of Storage Wars. I don't know how that was. But the other thing, more seriously, was those pictures of, piles of shoes and piles of suitcases, mm-hmm. from the Holocaust as mm-hmm. well. I mean, was that in your mind?
I mean, I definitely, had some of those, some of that imagery in mind. I'm not just saying this answer because I'm in London, and this is probably a boring answer anyway, but one of the things I really thought about is Our Mutual Friend is the Dickens novel, mm-hmm. right? Which, most people read and sort of don't understand, what is this dust man? He makes a fortune out of dust. What is this? And the idea that you would buy or steal people's dust, right? And you would collect it in these enormous mounds, and that you would do so because they made cheap bricks out of dust, and you would sell the dust to be made into bricks. So I was actually thinking about those scenes in Our Mutual Friend, which are just sort of like, I will steal shit, sometimes shit that nobody wants, mm-hmm. and it will be a mystery to most of the public about how I convert it into wealth. So I was kind of thinking about those systems. The imagery, though, I did have ideas of that imagery, though I also just did have these ideas of the individual storage lockers when you open them, and the way in which they seem like stage sets or dioramas, like if you go to like a natural history museum. I always liked, going to natural history, like I can't even conceive of a time when people thought that you know, dioramas in a natural history museum, like, looked interesting. Like, they just, haven't they always looked corny? Mm-hmm. That there was sort of always this, you know, strange, you know, creature, like an anteater, which always had its, like, you know, nose up and was always posed in that way. I was kind of thinking of these, like, strange nature dioramas where you're almost interrupting these scenes of life.
But also those rooms where it's like, this is a room from the 1950s, and right. There's like a, totally. You know, there's a barrier over it, so you can mm-hmm. look into the room, but you can't actually
right. Right. As get if, into as it. If everyone lived having bought everything at once. Mm-hmm. You know, like everyone went to the equivalent of IKEA in 1950, whatever, and bought everything made in the same year. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking a lot about this stuff, but I was also thinking about, you know, storage. You know, it's just amazing that storage places exist. There are these buildings that just take up space mm-hmm. with shit that, you know, people don't want to keep in their own spaces. And I think a large part of my interest in them actually came up with, you know, there are these two storage companies in New York that kind of people, some of them just, they ran effective marketing campaigns, you know. One just had sort of like witty slogans, you know, and the other one just really painted their buildings in interesting ways so they didn't look like these ugly gray, you know, wartime pillboxes just sitting in the middle of somewhere. And I remember saying that, like, this isn't enough. You can't just paint this shit, you know? And, yeah. And, you know, in various stories would crop up of, you know, people, you know, living in their storage facilities, mm-hmm. people kind of, you know, dealing drugs out of their moving facilities. And so I have storage facilities, so yeah.
But it's not that sort of final victory of capitalism, isn't it? It's not like, you've got too much stuff. What does that tell you? Perhaps you should buy less. No, it's, yeah. we've got this place. You can put the stuff that you right, can't perhaps, fit into your own and house perhaps into another
you,
place.
Perhaps you can pay rent
yeah.
on your inability to control your own expenditure. Sure. And not only that, but also once you default on it, you know, then it belongs to the storage mm. unit, and then they auction it. And yeah, there is that sort of element in it. I mean, and you're right. The storage wars or any of these reality TV show kind of things. And it's funny how, you know, those things are always this. They always keep the truly sad stories sort of off of those, you know, off of those things. But I always thought it was like I always thought if you could make the real storage wars, you know, where someone like truly defaulted and is going to lose everything that they
own. And then they open up the thing and see what you've wanted. There's a guy living in there.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I think that's about it for me. But could I get you to read a little bit of Moving Kings before we finish?
Sure. Yoav was moving between Harlem and the Village, Staten Island and the Bronx. He was trucking across the Verrazano, the Throgs Neck, the George Washington, or coming through the Lincoln Tunnel, because 4-5 and 6-axle trucks were prohibited from using the Holland, heading to Jersey, to load a whole apartment into the hold of a 12-footer, to unload all the foam-cushioned contents of a brownstone packed inside a 21-footer, in a tractor trailer towing an entire office building, in a pickup dropping off potted rubber trees and sacks of mulch, in a cargo van containing chandeliers for a midtown penthouse and Hampton's summer bicycles. The traffic flowed like the rivers, sometimes south, sometimes north, and sometimes in both directions simultaneously, which was sometimes not at all. A group of guys go out hard, swarming the houses of strangers, taking the furniture apart, taking the furniture away, breaking shit by accident and not by accident, committing petty theft by accident and not by accident or always petty, leaving everything empty, leaving everything a mess. Who would have guessed that the army had been training him for moving? Which meant that moving was what? A duty? A calling? A job, another occupation. A pregnant couple transitioning from a single-room situation to an extra-room situation. A pair of grown siblings who'd already evacuated their geriatric parents into assisted living from out of the Classic 6 condo they were looting. The customers, they'd lead the way in a taxi up front, and the moving truck would follow just behind, taking the transverse through the park, cross town, from where the sun rises on the Upper East to where it sets on the Upper West. No matter who drove or rode, Yoav would be sitting bitch in the middle. This was always the fragile time, the breakable time, the time of slip and slide and jostle. The ride between the old apartment already moved out and the new apartment not yet moved into, during which life itself would come to feel like just another vehicle set in motion between unrelated emptinesses. For a moment, your burdens were suspended. For a certain span of mileage, you were weightless. You were free.
So I've been talking to Joshua Cohen about his latest novel, Moving Kings, which is out in the UK from Fitzcarraldo Editions. Joshua, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.